Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman.
Perhaps it's still the romance and mystery of flight, but mysteries in the sky always capture our imagination. The disappearance of Amelia Earhart, the whereabouts of D.B. Cooper, the loss of Navy Flight 19 that disappeared somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle, or the 1990 mystery of Egypt Air 990. But because of our world of 24/7 news, none of these has quite captured our attention like the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. And at the center of that coverage, as many of you remember, was CNN and its decision to go almost wall-to-wall with coverage. Leading that coverage was longtime aviation correspondent Richard Quest. In a coincidence, Quest had interviewed and been photographed with the co-pilot just a few weeks before the disappearance. Richard Quest is CNN's aviation correspondent and business anchor for CNN International. He's covered airline, aviation, and the travel industry for more than 25 years, and he's just written The Vanishing of Flight MH370, the true story of the hunt for the missing Malaysian plane. Richard Quest, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, you know, you have just eloquently and elegantly summed up exactly this romance of aviation, which is tinged with the ultimate mystery of what happened to this 777 with 239 people on board.
Indeed, and there is a certain romance to it, a certain mystery, but one of the other sides of that, and certainly you've been talking about this and dealing with this from the very beginning, is as a result, all the theories, all the speculation, all the things that people think about with respect to this.
Yes, I mean the starting point 2 years on, the starting point has to be that they've no real idea where the plane is. They've got a rough idea. They're searching, 46,000 square miles, somewhere 1,500 miles off the coast of Australia. So they've got a rough idea of where it is, but no more precision than that. And they've absolutely no idea what caused the plane to go missing in the first place. They do not know whether it was nefarious from either hijacker or pilot suicide, nor do they know whether it was a mechanical problem. And that has to be our starting point for a discussion here, because circumstances and facts conspired to make this happen in this way.
And in fact, as you talk about, it really does come down to two things. Either there was some overwhelming mechanical problem that they try to solve that ultimately overwhelmed the crew, or there was human intervention in some way, be it a hijacking, a suicide, or something like that.
Yes, and in terms of what's interesting about the mechanical that you talk about, there has to have been something that takes out all the radios in one go, or all the communications equipment in one go. It's got to be serious enough the pilots turn around, and eventually they succumb from either fumes. But it can't be so serious that the plane doesn't keep flying for another 6 hours. So, for instance, this idea that the lithium batteries in the hold set on fire, I don't really go with that one, because if there was a lithium fire in the hold, that's pretty fierce and the plane would burn up. We know this from previous cases. Finding the mechanical reason is the difficult one.
What about this issue of the communications equipment, that much of the equipment being manually turned off?
There are three areas. You've got the satellite communications, known as the ACARS, you've got the radios, and you've got the transponder, which sends out an electronic signal. Now, we know that the transponder was either disabled or failed. We know that or switched off. We know that the ACARS satellite system stopped sending information. We know that there was no further radio call after Goodnight Malaysia 370 at about 19 minutes past 1. But was this because one of the pilots, probably the captain Zahari Ahmed, had taken over the plane? This captain was interesting. He's not the one I met. I met the first officer.
Right.
This captain was interesting. He had in his home a homemade flight simulator, which he liked to practice different flight techniques on. It was a bit more than your normal flight simulator that you buy from Microsoft. This had, screens, it had a proper yoke, it had proper equipment. But And some people say he had practiced flying routes to the Southern Oceans, but so far nobody's come out and said that publicly. And in fact, the report on the first anniversary, Jeff, the report actually says that there was no disturbances in the pilots' lives. So you've got to take it, you know, there are those people who say, no, no, it was the pilots. They did it. But I haven't found any evidence of that yet.
What do we know about the co-pilot, the second officer who you met, Farik Abdul-Hamid?
27 years old, engaged to be married, didn't have much of a social media presence, which some people found suspicious. He had started on the 737s, he'd then flown the A330s, and now he was graduating to the 777s. And when I asked him, why did he want to fly the 777, he said, look, you know, it's a bigger plane, obviously more money, more excitement, seniority, and I get to fly to more interesting destinations like London, Rome, and Sydney.
Talk a little bit about the coincidence of you having met him literally weeks before the disappearance of 370.
I'm glad you used the word coincidence, because according to the conspiracy theorists, this was CNN who had an inkling that something was going to happen. We were responsible. Not a bit of it. What happened was we had been in Hong Kong. We were going to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia to do a story on Malaysia Airlines. And Farik Hamid was the co-pilot on the 777. I'd never met him before. And he was a charming chap. And I've still got the video in my iPhone of him landing that 777 because I was on the flight deck for the landing in KL. Do you know something? I can't erase it. I really can't. It's as if I look at it and I think, what on earth did you know? What was it like? What role, if any, did you play, Farik? Were you the man who did it? Should I have spotted something when we flew together 2 weeks previously? Of course, I'm just playing tricks with my mind. There's nothing on that tape. There's no indication. It's always perfectly normal.
Beyond the equipment that apparently was turned off in some way that you spoke about a few minutes ago, there was this whole issue of the plane changing course four different times, changes that would have had to have been manually programmed into its computer.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt that the plane's about turn was manually commanded, whether by the wheel of the yoke or by the turning the so-called heading select. So there's no doubt it was one of the pilots did do it. The question is, did they do it with nefarious intent, or did they do it because they were trying to get back to Malaysia because of a problem on board? I've heard the view, and many pilots have said, they were trying to get to Penang on the western coast of Malaysia, which has a very long runway, one of the longest in Southeast Asia. And the captain would have known that, and he would have known that that was the safest place to try and get to. But there are those who say, no, the captain's simulator had practiced flying to remote islands, and the captain's wife supposedly was about to leave him. The captain supposedly was very upset that one of his distant relatives, who was a Malaysian politician, had just been prosecuted and convicted. There's no, or at least little, truth in any of those assumptions about the captain. His wife hadn't left him. He was a supporter of Ibrahim, but not a fanatic. The report says there were no major changes in his personal life. We are left with basically not knowing.
What do we know about Malaysia Airlines, its reputation, its history?
I've flown Malaysia Airlines many times. It is a proud carrier. Going back to the 1970s, it had a long, distinguished safety record. And then hard times arrive. Like many carriers, on the one hand, it's trying to beat the Gulf 3, Qatar, Emirates, and Etihad, which is scooping up the long-haul business. And then on the other hand, it's got the low-cost carriers like AirAsia and Tiger. It's exactly the same situation that we're seeing in Europe with legacy airlines like Lufthansa, Air France, Alitalia, British Airways, and to some extent, even in the United States. But in the US, the low costs, JetBlues and Southwests, Allegiants and Spirits, they've made headway. Spirit's the largest carrier in some ways. Southwest is the largest carrier. But the legacy carriers have managed to transform themselves, United, Delta, and American. They did it with consolidation, and they've done it with, you know, cutting costs and bankruptcies. So Malaysia Airlines certainly found itself and has found itself in a very difficult financial position as it tries to work out what its role is in the future. It's now being taken back into government ownership, and that's where it will remain until profitability arrives.
The other overlay to all of this is the air traffic control system itself in that region of the world. And one of the things that this whole story has done, and certainly in the search and in the lack of information, is it really has exposed so much of the weakness in the air traffic control system in that part of the world.
On the night, Jeff, it was a shambles. And you had air traffic controllers saying, oh, have you heard from Singapore? Well, why don't you ask what Vietnam's? Oh, well, let's have a word with Malaysia Airlines. Oh, no, have you spoken to Cambodia? And then Malaysia says, oh, no, we've got a report from that. It was a horrible, horrible mess. For hours, it went backwards and forwards between them all. And I wish I could say this was unique, but it's not. We saw exactly the same thing with Air France 447 some 5 years earlier. This is the nature of it. They're too slow sometimes at sounding the alarm. And it's not because they don't want to. It's because nobody sees the full picture. Now, there are those who suggest if it was the pilot who was responsible, he chose exactly the right moment to do what he did when the plane was being transferred from Malaysian to Vietnamese airspace. That, if you like, is the crack where you hope to fall between. But if you look at the transcript of air traffic control, they did a really bad job.
Do you believe that? If you take the position, And understanding this and having looked at it as you have, if you take the position that it was intentional in some way, do you buy into the theory that that would have been the precise moment to do it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes. You do it hoping that it's going to be the precise moment. But the rules are such, I'll give you an example. The rules are such that, you know, Vietnam expects to hear from MH370 within about 5 minutes of a handover. But it was 15 minutes before they called back and said, we haven't heard from MH370. So if the rules had been followed, then this would not have fallen between the cracks, if you get my drift. It was the middle of the night. People are tired. We know that Malaysia Air Traffic Control was short-staffed. The pilots knew this route backwards, or at least the captain did. Everything conspired. Incompetence, poor procedures, poor following of procedures. Everything conspired to make sure that the alarm was not raised as quickly as it should have been.
When we look at the four route changes that the plane made, what does that tell us? What can we glean from that in terms of where it might have been headed?
We can't, I don't think. I mean, I believe that it was headed back to Malaysia, and then either the crew became overwhelmed, or, as some like David Soucy believed, the crew realized that the plane was in trouble and wanted to head out to sea to make sure it didn't crash into a city in the ultimate act of sacrifice. And then there are those who say, no, that's simply too far-fetched, Richard. What happened here was the pilots took command, or one of the pilots took command of the aircraft and was determined to kill everybody on board. The route changes, I mean, for instance, one person suggests that what the captain was doing was flying back to his home in Penang. He was going to circle over his ancestral home to have a final goodbye before he then flew off to kill everybody in the ocean. I don't buy it. I just don't buy it.
Talk about your decision, really CNN's decision, Jeff Zucker's decision, to cover this story the way you did.
It was part of his fundamental strategy, having just taken over at CNN, that Jeff's view has always been that CNN is like the fifth, it's like the spare tire in the spare wheel in the car. Everybody's delighted to have it when big news breaks, but you forget about it for the rest of the time. And part of this strategy is when big news happens, we go all in. We absolutely throw everything and anything at it. And this was the first sizable evidence of this strategy. We had dozens of people in Malaysia, in Perth, Western Australia, up in Vietnam, in Beijing. We deployed to London. I mean, we had people everywhere. There was one moment when I was actually asked, could we charter a real 777 so we could film what it was like in the cockpit? I pointed out that it was going to cost tens, if not hundreds of thousands. No problem. If somebody will rent it to us, we will charter it. Unfortunately, we couldn't find any airline anywhere in the world that would charter to us.
Talk a little bit about the search effort that covered some 200,000 square miles and to date has cost well over $100 million.
It's not really that much. And even if it is that much, it is still less than the cost of a brand new 777-300. So we have to have an element of perspective about this. The plane's cost is still, that the search has been long and hard, and it's harder because we're not even sure we're in the right area, where there's no heavy evidence. There's only these so-called Inmarsat handshakes, which are just guiding people to this area. But the search has been long and hard. It's expensive. The three governments involved, the Chinese, the Malaysians, and the Australians, have said at the end of this search, there will be no extension if they haven't found the plane. And just this morning, I got an email from an organization who is Voice of 370, representing the families, saying, No. We've got to keep searching. You've got to keep searching. Even if you don't find it now, you have to expand the area. We cannot just stop.
And talk about the families, the influence that they've had, the impact that they've had in directing this search effort.
The families were very badly treated by both Malaysia government and Malaysia Airlines. And the Chinese weren't any more helpful. Let's be honest about this. The Chinese were deeply unhelpful throughout. But the families have always said, and I've interviewed many of them, that there's been some form of cover-up. Now, what form that cover-up takes, they're not prepared to say, oh, they don't know. But they all believe, and many of them don't think the pilots did it. They think the Malaysians may have shot it down, or at least somebody in Malaysia knows more than they're letting on. And the reason, of course, is, as you read in the book, there was a radar operator who saw the plane flying across the country on the night, and he did nothing. So what culpability is there for that radar operator, for those who saw what happened? And are there people who know, and many people who are not crackpots, and they're not the conspiracy theorists, but many people do believe that there are those who know a lot more than they're letting on.
And finally, Richard, as somebody that has looked at this story, that has covered it intimately for 48 months now, what do you think?
I think it was mechanical. I think the profile does not look like that of pilot suicide. I think there's no evidence of distress in the pilot's lives. No smoking gun has been found. There's been no insurance policy. There's been no disciplinary action. There's been no sexual allegations. There's been no reason, no serious reason, why this captain or first officer would have taken over their own aircraft and crashed it.
Richard Quest,
Richard, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
And I thank you, sir, for giving me that time.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.